Chapter 24. Neither could Vinicius discover the cause of what had happened, and in the bottom of his soul he was almost as much astonished and as Chio, that those people should treat him as they had, and, instead of avenging his attack, dress his wounds carefully, he ascribed partly to the doctrine which they confessed, more to Lydia, and a little, also, to his great significance. But their conduct with Chilo simply went beyond his understanding of man's power of forgiveness. And the question thrust itself into his mind. Why did they not kill the Greek? They might have killed him with impunity. Ursus would have buried him in the garden, or borne him in the dark to the Tiber, which during that period of night murders, committed by Caesar himself even, cast up human bodies so frequently in the morning that no one inquired whence they came. To his thinking, the Christians had not only the power, but the right to kill Chio. True, pity was not entirely a stranger to that world to which the young patrician belonged. The Athenians raised an altar to pity, and opposed for a long time the introduction of gladiatorial combats into Athens. In Rome itself the conquered received pardon sometimes, as, for instance, Callicratus, king of the Britons, who, taken prisoner in the time of Claudius, and provided for by him bountifully, dwelt in the city in freedom. But vengeance for a personal wrong seemed to Vinicius, as to all, proper and justified. The neglect of it was entirely opposed to his spirit. True, he had heard in Astrianum that one should love even enemies, that, however, he considered as a kind of theory without application in life. And now this passed through his head, that perhaps they had not killed Chilo, because the day was among festivals, or was in some period of the moon during which it was not proper for Christians to kill a man. He had heard that there are days among various nations on which it is not permitted to begin war even. But why, in such a case, did they not deliver the Greek up to justice? Why did the apostle say that, if a man offended seven times, it was necessary to forgive him seven times? And why did Glaucus say to Chio, "May God forgive thee, as I forgive thee"? Chilo had done him the most terrible wrong that one man could do another. At the very thought of how he would act with a man who killed Lydia, for instance, the heart of Vinicius seized up, as does water in a cauldron. There were no torments which he would not inflict in his vengeance. But Glaucus had forgiven. Ursus too, had forgiven. Ursus, who might in fact kill whomever he wished in Rome with perfect impunity, for all he needed, was to kill the king of the grove in Nemi, and take his place. Could the gladiator holding that office to which he had succeeded, only by killing the previous king, resist the man whom Croton could not resist? There was only one answer to all these questions. That they refrained from killing him through a goodness so great, that the like of it had not been in the world up to that time, and through an unbounded love of man, which commands to forget oneself, one's wrongs, one's happiness and misfortune, and live for others. What reward those people were to receive for this, Vinicius heard in Astrianum, but he could not understand it. He felt, however, that the earthly life connected with the duty of renouncing everything good and rich for the benefit of others must be wretched. So in what he thought of the Christians at that moment, besides the greatest astonishment, there was pity, and as it were a shade of contempt. It seemed to him that they were sheep which earlier or later must be eaten by wolves. His Roman nature could yield no recognition to people who let themselves be devoured. This one thing struck him, however, that after Chilo's departure the faces of all were bright with a certain deep joy. The apostle approached Glaucus, placed his hand on his head, and said, "Antichrist has triumphed." The other raised his eyes, which were full of hope, and as bright with joy, as if some great unexpected happiness had been poured on him. Vinicius, who could understand only joy or delight born of vengeance, looked on him with eyes staring from fever, and somewhat as he would on a madman. He saw, however, and saw not without internal indignation, that Lydia pressed her lips of a queen to the hand of that man, who had the appearance of a slave, and it seemed to him that the order of the world was inverted utterly. Next, Ursus told how he had conducted Shiloh to the street, and had asked forgiveness for the harm which he might have done his bones. For this the apostle blessed him also. Crispus declared that it was a day of great victory. Hearing of this victory, Vinicius lost the thread of his thought altogether. But when Lygia gave him a cooling draught again, he held her hand for a moment, and asked, "Then must thou also forgive me? We are Christians. It is not permitted us to keep anger in the heart." "Lygia," said he, "whoever thy God is, I honor him only because he is thine. Thou wilt honor him in thy heart when thou lovest him." "Only because he is thine," repeated Vinicius, in a fainter voice, and he closed his eyes, for weakness had mastered him again. Lygia went out, but returned after a time, and bent over him to learn if he were sleeping. Vinicius, feeling that she was near, opened his eyes and smiled. She placed her hand over them lightly, as if to incline him to slumber. A great sweetness seized him then, but soon he felt more grievously ill than before, and was very ill in reality. Night had come, and with it a more violent fever. He could not sleep, and followed Lygia with his eyes wherever she went. At times he fell into a kind of doze, in which he saw and heard everything which happened around him, but in which reality was mingled with feverish dreams. It seemed to him that in some old, deserted cemetery stood a temple, in the form of a tower, in which Lygia was priestess. He did not take his eyes from her, but saw her on the summit of the tower, with a lute in her hands, all in the light, like those priestesses who in the nighttime sing hymns in honor of the moon, and whom he had seen in the Orient. He himself was climbing up winding steps, with great effort, to bear her away with him. Behind was creeping up Chio, with teeth chattering from terror, and repeating, "Do not do that, Lord. She is a priestess, for whom he will take vengeance." Vinicius did not know who that he was, but he understood that he himself was going to commit some sacrilege, and he felt a boundless fear also. But when he went to the balustrade surrounding the summit of the tower, the apostle with his silvery beard stood at Lygia's side on a sudden, and said, "Do not raise a hand, she belongs to me." Then he moved forward with her, on a path formed by rays from the moon, as if on a path made to heaven. He stretched his hands toward them, and begged both to take him into their company. Here he woke, became conscious, and looked before him. The lamp on the tall staff shone more dimly, but still cast a light sufficiently clear. All were sitting in front of the fire warming themselves, for the night was chilly, and the chamber rather cold. Vinicius saw the breath coming as steam from their lips. In the midst of them sat the apostle. At his knees, on a low footstool, was Lygia. Farther on, Glaucus, Crispus, Miriam, and at the edge, on one side Ursus, on the other Miriam's son Nazarius, a youth with a handsome face, and long, dark hair reaching down to his shoulders. Lygia listened with eyes raised to the apostle, and every head was turned toward him, while he told something in an undertone. Vinicius gazed at Peter with a certain superstitious awe, hardly inferior to that terror which he felt during the fever dream. The thought passed through his mind that that dream had touched truth, that the gray-haired man there, freshly come from distant shores, would take Lygia from him really, and take her somewhere away by unknown paths. He felt sure also that the old man was speaking of him, perhaps telling how to separate him from Lygia, for it seemed to him impossible that anyone could speak of aught else. Hence, collecting all his presence of mind, he listened to Peter's words. But he was mistaken altogether, for the apostle was speaking of Christ again. "They live only through that name," thought Vinicius. The old man was describing the seizure of Christ. A company came, and servants of the priest to seize him. When the Savior asked whom they were seeking, they answered, "Jesus of Nazareth." But when he said to them, "I am he," they fell on the ground, and dared not raise a hand on him. Only after the second inquiry did they seize him. Here the apostle stopped, stretched his hands toward the fire and continued. The night was cold, like this one, but the heart in me was seething. So, drawing a sword to defend him, I cut an ear from the servant of the high priest. I would have defended him more than my own life had he not said to me, "Put thy sword into the sheath. The cup which my father has given me, shall I not drink it?" Then they seized and bound him. When he had spoken thus far, Peter placed his palm on his forehead, and was silent, wishing before he went further to stop the crowd of his recollections. But Ursus, unable to restrain himself, sprang to his feet, trimmed the light on the staff till the sparks scattered in golden rain, and the flame shot up with more vigor. Then he sat down, and exclaimed, "No matter what happened, he stopped suddenly, for Lydia had put her finger to her lips. But he breathed loudly, and it was clear that a storm was in his soul, and though he was ready at all times to kiss the feet of the apostle, that act was one he could not accept. If someone in his presence had raised hands on the Redeemer, if he had been with him on that night, splinters would have shot from the soldiers, the servants of the priest, and the officials." Tears came to his eyes at the very thought of this, and because of his sorrow and mental struggle. For on the one hand he thought that he would not only have defended the Redeemer, but would have called legions to his aid, splendid fellows, and on the other, if he had acted thus he would have disobeyed the Redeemer, and hindered the salvation of man. For this reason he could not keep back his tears. After a while Peter took his palm from his forehead, and resumed the narrative. But Vinicius was overpowered by a new feverish, waking dream. What he heard now was in his mind mixed up with what the apostle had told the night previous in Istrianum, of that day in which Christ appeared on the shore of the Sea of Tiberias. He saw a sheet of water broadly spread out, on it the boat of a fisherman, and in the boat Peter and Lydia. He himself was moving with all his might after that boat, but pain in his broken arm prevented him from reaching it. The wind hurled waves in his eyes, he began to sink, and called with entreating voice for rescue. Lydia knelt down then before the apostle, who turned his boat, and reached an oar, which Vinicius seized. With their assistance he entered the boat, and fell on the bottom of it. It seemed to him, then, that he stood up, and saw a multitude of people sailing after them. Waves covered their heads with foam. In the whirl only the hands of a few could be seen, but Peter saved the drowning time after time, and gathered them into his boat, which grew larger, as if by a miracle. Soon crowds filled it, as numerous as those which were collected in Istrianum, and then still greater crowds. Vinicius wondered how they could find place there, and he was afraid that they would sink to the bottom. But Lydia pacified him, by showing him a light on the distant shore toward which they were sailing. These dream pictures of Vinicius were blended again with descriptions which he had heard in Istrianum, from the lips of the apostle, as to how Christ had appeared on the lake once. So that he saw now in that light on the shore a certain form toward which Peter was steering, and as he approached it the weather grew calmer, the water grew smoother, the light became greater. The crowd began to sing sweet hymns. The air was filled with the odor of nard. The play of water formed a rainbow, as if from the bottom of the lake lilies and roses were looking, and at last the boat struck its breast safely against the sand. Lydia took his hand then, and said, "Come, I will lead thee," and she led him to the light. Vinicius woke again, but his dreaming ceased slowly, and he did not recover at once the sense of reality. It seemed for a time to him that he was still on the lake, and surrounded by crowds, among which, not knowing the reason himself, he began to look for Petronius, and was astonished not to find him. The bright light from the chimney, at which there was no one at that time, brought him completely to his senses. Olive sticks were burning slowly under the rosy ashes. But the splinters of pine, which evidently had been put there some moments before, shot up a bright flame, and in the light of this, Vinicius saw Lydia, sitting not far from his bedside. The sight of her touched him to the depth of his soul. He remembered that as he had spent the night before in Astrianum, and had busied herself the whole day in nursing him, and now when all had gone to rest, she was the only one watching. It was easy to divine that she must be wearied, for while sitting motionless her eyes were closed. Vinicius knew not whether she was sleeping or sunk in thought. He looked at her profile, at her drooping lashes, at her hands lying on her knees, and in his pagan head the idea began to hatch with difficulty that at the sight of naked beauty, confident and proud of Greek and Roman symmetry, there is another in the world, new, immensely pure, in which a soul has its dwelling. He could not bring himself so far as to call it Christian, but, thinking of Lydia, he could not separate her from the religion which he confessed. He understood, even, that if all the others had gone to rest, and she alone were watching, she whom he had injured, it was because her religion commanded her to watch. But that thought, which filled him with wonder for the religion, was disagreeable to him. He would rather that Lydia acted thus out of love for him, his face, his eyes, his statuesque form, in a word for reasons, because of which more than one snow-white Grecian and Roman arms had been wound around his neck. Still he felt all at once that, were she like other women, something would be lacking in her. He was amazed, and knew not what was happening in him, for he saw that new feelings of some kind were rising in him, new likings, strange to the world in which he had lived hitherto. She opened her eyes then, and, seeing that Vinicius was gazing at her, she approached him and said, "I'm with thee." "I saw thy soul in a dream," replied he. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.